Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. We're continuing a conversation we briefly began in the last hour with Dr. Tremper Longman. He's professor of biblical studies at Westmont College, author, co-author of a book called Show Them No Mercy, Four Views on God and the Canaanite Genocide. He has also written an article in the recent issue of Christianity Today magazine titled The God of War. What we're really talking about is whether or not the warrior God that is very clearly depicted in the Old Testament is also a warrior God in the New Testament. It's the same God, but does God change temperament or character from old to new? We're starting with the problem of war in the Old Testament. Dr. Longman, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, picking up where we were and recapping, if we could, why did God command his people entering the land to carry out what appears to us to be, for lack of a better word, genocide?
Well, it's very clearly explained in the Old Testament as an act of God's judgment. So that's why God commands it. And it is very interesting, by the way, if I might say, that Israel doesn't escape God's judgment when they disobey the covenant, you know, that at places like Ai, which is the battle after Jericho, in the early years of Samuel, when Eli's the priest and his sons are defeated by the Philistines and the ark's captured, and then most clearly at the time of the Babylonian defeat of Judah, as explained in the Book of Lamentations. So the Old Testament isn't kind of a sort of pro-Israel, Israel right or wrong kind of document either.
So this is a God who is, as you said before, both loving, merciful, and holy and just,
yeah,
and consistent, whether he be dealing with the evil of his enemies, the Canaanites, or the evil among his own people.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I think we're to look at this and be awed at who God is, and it should motivate us to follow him and obey him now.
There's also a penalty that is exacted upon, and you made brief mention of this, a penalty that is exacted upon God's people if they fail to carry out the so-called ban against the Canaanite.
Oh, yeah. Right, that's right. And you see that in a place like Joshua, where after the Battle of Jericho, when an individual named Achan keeps some of the plunder for himself, and then they go up to Ai. And it's interesting, a lot of English readers miss this, but Jericho is this legendary, powerful city that is easily defeated because God is fighting with them, whereas they go up to Ai, and the very Hebrew name of the city is kind of like dump. It's a small city, it's like a ruin, but because they've disobeyed, God has them defeated in the initial battle at Ai. So God takes this very seriously in the Old Testament, and you see it too later on with Saul, who doesn't carry out the harem, and that's the occasion for his losing the kingship.
Does it go hand in hand? You mentioned Saul. Does this modus operandi for war in the Old Testament go hand in hand with God's injunction to rid the land of the other evils of the Canaanite, their gods, their religious practices, their high places, the sorceries, and things like that?
Yes, very definitely. That's why. And when they don't complete the conquest, it becomes a real problem for Israel later on.
How important for understanding warfare in the Old Testament, and then, of course, as it informs the God of War in the New, how important is it for us to understand something you said before, and that it is God who is actually engaging in battle on behalf of his people?
Well, that is really the center of Old Testament warfare, that it's Yahweh who is leading his heavenly armies into battle, And in the Old Testament, warfare is considered an act of worship, because at those periods when the Ark of the Covenant was in existence, the Ark would be taken into battle, and so the soldiers would have to be in a state of ritual purity, as if they were going into the very tabernacle or temple. It's an act of worship, and you see in place like 2 Chronicles 20, when Jehoshaphat leads the army into a battle against the Moabites, that the priests are leading it, and they're singing hymns as they go into battle.
People will look at some of the bloodier chapters of the Old Testament, and I'm thinking about in the period of the Judges, Samson in particular, who after a very bloody life of killing Philistines, among others, is hailed, his epitaph is that he's honored for the fact that he killed more in death than he did in life.
Right, yes. And again, we have to remember that during the Old Testament time period, as opposed to the present period between the first and second coming of Christ, that God was waging war against his flesh and blood enemies, using Israel as his tool. And even somebody like Samson, who does it very unconsciously, unintentionally, you know, he's usually damaging the enemy when he's actually sort of working out his own desires and lusts. Even at the end, it says, "Let me have vengeance for my two eyes," when he pushes the pillars. God overrules his intentions to bring about what is considered a good in the Old Testament, which is the defeat of these oppressive powers.
Moving to the New Testament, then, Dr. Longman, the common conception is that while we'll admit there's a warrior God in the Old Testament, who very clearly depicts himself as a warrior and acts as one,
yeah,
the God of the New Testament is the diplomat God. He is, he might even be the pacifist God.
Well, yeah, that's a good way of putting the issue. But it's very clear that Christ is a warrior, but he is a warrior in a different way, with the object being Satan himself. It's, as I described it earlier, an intensification and heightening of the warfare. And you can see this in a variety of ways, but a couple notable places are you know, when he approaches the cross and Peter pulls out his sword, he says to Peter, "Put away your sword. If I wanted to, I could have myriads of my Father's heavenly army here." But he goes to the cross and dies, and Paul, in a place like Colossians 2:13-15, very much sees this as the great military victory. He uses military language there to describe the death and resurrection of Christ. And then Ephesians 5, quoting Psalm 68, which is a warrior hymn, and there are many warrior hymns in the Psalms, he'll talk about the ascension as leading captivity captive, which is, you know, that sort of post-battle parade of victory. So the New Testament very much understands the death and resurrection of Christ as a spiritual military victory, and then envisions our life today, as I said, in Ephesians 6 and many other places. 2 Corinthians 10 uses military language to describe our spiritual battle, you know, and we use spiritual weapons now. But again, it all looks forward to the second coming, when Christ will appear again as a warrior, but this time combining the two and bringing the victory to a completion. So again, it's not an Old Testament versus New Testament. It is a what I call a battle strategy that unfolds where God defeats evil in this world.
So is it fair to say that we ought to view the Old Testament battle plan of God, in which comes to us very concrete literal terms, as of one kind of as of one battle plan with
right.
the New Testament battle plan of God, in which God comes himself in human flesh but engages the real enemies or the enemy behind the real enemies, I guess.
I think that second way is the best way of putting it. It's the enemy behind the real enemy. The human enemies are still enemies, and there is a spiritual battle going on now, it's very important for Christians to keep in mind that the warfare is directed towards spiritual enemies with spiritual weapons. I mean, this is what differentiates us from Islamic fundamentalists who would argue that a physical jihad is still going on today. But unfortunately, I mean, there's a minority of radical Christians, or people who at least claim to be Christians, who will still, you know, take somebody like, I forget his name, down in Florida, who shot the abortion doctor. That's very much a betrayal of the gospel, taking up a physical weapon in that way, in the defense of Christ. This is a different question, though, than whether, you know, modern warfare can be justified.
And so, in other words, the radical Muslim,
right,
will take the calls to jihad as calls to warfare, physical warfare, against his fellow man. The Christian who does the same thing with Old Testament passages,
yeah,
is engaging in the same error as the Muslim in that case, if he thinks that the Old Testament justifies Christians taking up arms as Christians,
right,
against the enemies of God.
Right. That's right. You cannot use the Old Testament holy war passages to justify modern warfare. Now, I personally do think that it is very possible to defend a just war theory on the Bible, but not from those passages. It's almost a whole nother topic.
Sure it is. I mean, and then we would have to engage in a whole question about what the Reformers and Luther in particular distinguished between the two kingdoms, and
yeah,
perhaps we could do that at another time. I'm curious about the irony. If Christ is in fact engaged in the same cosmic battle,
yes,
that he engaged in the Old Testament pre-incarnately through,
yeah,
the people of Israel, when he finally comes to the final battlefield, the irony is he is not only the only combatant, he's the only casualty.
Yeah, it is. It's a tremendous irony and paradox that even through John the Baptist, if you'll remember for a loop, before he baptizes him, he announces the coming of the Messiah in terms very similar to Old Testament prophets at the end of the Old Testament time period, as one who will burn the chaff and will cut down the rotten wood. But then when Jesus goes out and preaches the good news, he sends two disciples up and say, essentially, what's going on here? But what John the Baptist is seeing is, as prophets typically do, sees the future but doesn't differentiate the first from the second coming of Christ. So I think it was a surprise to a lot of people how Christ came as a warrior.
And would you go so far as to say that this isn't just some sort of a modern sensibility or modern definition that we are placing over the top of the text, but that Jesus himself saw himself, depicted himself as that the same warrior God of the Old Testament?
Oh, yes, very much. You could see this in a number of different ways. One very subtle one is the fact that, you know, Christ as cloud rider, a lot of us think of that picture as a picture of a white fluffy cloud. But if you go back and read the Old Testament passages of Yahweh riding the cloud, he rides a cloud into battle, and it's a storm cloud. It's very, very much that way. I wrote along with Dan Reed an earlier book called God is a Warrior, where I develop a lot of those connections.
Finally, as our conversation comes to a close here, someone will simply see the contrast and try and reconcile the two, that we've got a warrior God in the Old Testament, we've got the Savior in the New Testament saying, love your enemies. There's no doubt there's an enemy engaged here. How is this to be reconciled?
Well, I think that, in terms of, I think we do love our human enemies, and the way that we love them is by sharing the gospel with them, which paradoxically in and of itself is an act of spiritual warfare. If you share the gospel with somebody and they turn to Christ, what happens is, according to the language of Colossians, the old man dies spiritually and the new man rises. And so evangelism is kind of like spiritual warfare.
Dr. Trimper Longman, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you for inviting me, Todd.
Dr. Longman is professor of biblical studies at Westmont College, co-author of the book Show Them No Mercy, Four Views on God and the Canaanite Genocide. He has also written an article in the most recent issue of Christianity Today titled God, the God of War. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to spend time talking with our good friend Uwe Simonetto. He's religion editor for United Press International. He has been, racking up a lot of commentary and column and observation in that capacity. And we want to talk a little bit about some of the things he's been writing on lately. And a little later in the hour, why in the world was an article that was solicited from him, from the Christian Century, rejected? It was an article on the war. We're going to start out talking about the latest encyclical from Pope John Paul II on the Eucharist and the Church. Uwe Simonetto, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Great to be back. Thanks, Tom.
What has come from the Vatican, from the Pope, by way of this new encyclical?
Well, in this new encyclical letter, which is titled, which is called Church of the Eucharist, it states that normally people of ecclesial communities, which means Protestant churches, cannot commune at Catholic orders, and Catholics should not commune at Protestant altars. And this is, of course, there has been time for a Kirchentag, you know, these big church-wide assemblies that we have in Germany. This is the first ecumenical one, Protestant Catholic, and there's much agitation that there should be Eucharistic fellowship between the Catholics and the Protestants. And there will probably be some illicit concelebrations between Catholics and Protestants, and that's what it was time for.
So is this viewed by the ecumenical community, I'm thinking about World Council of Churches and things like this, as a roadblock to their attempts of bringing virtually all churches, Catholic and Protestant, into full communion with one another?
It is viewed by, or was described by many as that, indeed, although it's nothing new, actually, because in all previous encyclicals, it's been quite clearly stated that that we are not in communion yet, and one shouldn't take the last step before the first one. The last step would be, of course, the communion at the altar.
Now, why is it that the Pope is describing the Church in Eucharistic terms, the Eucharistic Church?
Well, to him, of course, the Church, the Eucharist is really what defines the Church. Which I think many of us can go along with. It is the place where the body of Christ unites. And so therefore he makes it very, very clear in his encyclical that this is one of the most important aspects of church life.
Is this going to, as an encyclical from the Pope, have essentially the force of canon law for Roman Catholics worldwide?
Well, he is reiterating really what is canon law. It's, as I said, you know, this is the Roman position, and he says, of course, we all want to eventually commune at the same altar, but right now we don't. We're not in full communion. Yes, it is. It is compulsory. There's an interesting aspect, though. He makes it also clear in this encyclical that where members of what he calls ecclesial communities, which means Protestant churches, in certain circumstances, in certain senses, desire the sacraments from the Roman Church, then they should not be refused. In other words, if you're serious about communing, if you're left without, say if you're Lutheran and you don't have a Lutheran church anywhere within a driving distance or in bed, and you do want to commune, then you can approach your local Catholic pastor, and presumably through the bishop, he would get clearance for that.
That would be the exception that proves the rule, however, right?
That would be the exception that proves the rule. However, it isn't, you know, I've been following this very carefully, and obviously I have a lot of discussions with my Catholic interlocutors on this issue. I think it is quite significant. What the Catholics are saying here and have been saying for quite some time is, well, you know, what are we actually doing when we commune? Are we just chewing on the body of Christ, or are we just chewing on some stale old wafer and say, hey, this is, wasn't it nice what they've done, what Christ has done for us 2,000 years ago? Or are we actually physically and spiritually experiencing the presence of Christ here and communing with Christ and with one another? And then there's the other issue, of course, according to the Roman Catholic Church, only priests ordained in the apostolic succession should consecrate the Eucharist. If you look at some Protestant denominations, you have Lutherans in Germany, Lutheran churches, for example, and here too, I suppose, where people who are not at all qualified and not ready to consecrate the Eucharist. I've seen students and I've seen lay people consecrate the Eucharist. So I think there is a, I think if we really want to have ecumenical commitment somewhere, we have to be honest with one another, A, with what we believe, and A, with who is doing what. And not just that we have some guy out there saying saying the words of institution. Often they don't even say speak the words of institution. So, you know, that it is on that level that much of the discussion is going on.
Dr. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He's religion editor for United Press International. When we come back, we will continue our conversation here on the Pope's Eucharistic No, as Uwe calls it, find out what the general reaction has been to this encyclical, and then we'll go on to talk about the Shroud of Turin. There has been a petition signed by 52 international scientists urging the Pope and the Vatican to protect the Turin Shroud. We'll find out about that and a few other things to talk about with Uwe Simonetto. He'll also answer the question, why is Europe so pacifistic, or at least it has been, when it comes to the war? We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Is the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ historically reliable? And what can we learn about this miraculous event from extra-biblical sources? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section, issuesetc.org. The Very First Easter is written by Dr. Paul Meyer, Professor of Ancient History at Western Michigan University. It's a great Easter gift for your children or your grandchildren. The book costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. The Very First Easter, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040.
Public schools and self-esteem. Answers with Ken Ham, one of the builders of a large creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Ken, there are leaders in America now calling for students to be taught self-esteem. What do you think of this?
Well, the problem is that unless we look at the world through the lens of the Bible, we'll not have the correct view of man to be able to even begin to solve school problems like student violence and so on. The Bible teaches clearly that all people are sinners in rebellion against their Creator. Each one of us has a conscience and really knows there's right and wrong. Also, God's Word teaches that each of us knows there is a God. It's written on our hearts. Thus, if one tries to tell someone they have self-worth without a biblical understanding of human nature, it just won't work. You see, people know deep down they're not basically good. True self-esteem can only be obtained when one understands that even though they're a sinner, they're very special. That's because our Creator became our Redeemer to pay the penalty for our sin. Young people need to know they're special, but this only works when they also understand their sin nature.
Now, the reason we have death, violence, and suffering today is because of the sin nature we've all inherited from Adam. Well, Ken Ham tackles this topic in his free booklet on death and suffering. It's available when you log on to our attractive and easy-to-navigate website, AnswersRadio.com. Next time you're in front of your computer, make sure you log on to AnswersRadio.com.
At AM 850 KFUO. More with Uwe Simonetto to round off the third hour of Issues Etc. this afternoon. Weather for St. Louis, mostly cloudy tonight with a chance for rain, low of about 63. Thursday looks like this. Cloudy, showers and thunderstorms are likely. High near 79, currently overcast, and 84 in St. Louis. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Westbound 40 heavy from Clayton, Skinker to Hanley and McKnight. Then Bellis to Mason. Eastbound 270 slows from east of McDonald Boulevard to Lindbergh. Northbound 270 between Page and Dorset. There's some slow traffic there. Then heavy in the right lanes to the 70 exits. Westbound 44 at 270 slow traffic in the right lane. Northbound 55 is backed up onto eastbound 44 at 18th Street heading for the Poplar Street Bridge. And eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge. There's some slow traffic there. That's traffic and weather on AM 850 KFUO.
Sign on at 6:30 with AM 850 KFUO. Wake up with inspiration, information, and some good friends on the radio. Hi, this is Paul Clayton. Jane Wilkie joins us from Lutheran Hour Ministries. Commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer. And then Pastor Jolly John Lukomsky. And we'll play Bible Brain Teaser and give you the final clue to help you solve this week's AM 850 KFUO Daily Bible Quiz, The Morning Show, on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., Christians and Mental Illness. Linda Preuss will be our guest tomorrow on the program. Also, Dr. Jean Edward Veith, author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for May, called The Spirituality of the Cross. We'll talk with him about the doctrine of justification. And last night, it was Dateline, I think, that carried an interview with Madonna. Not the Madonna, but Madonna. Along with a change of hair color and several other things, she opined on the Kabbalah, her preference in spiritual matters. So-called ancient Jewish mysticism, Gnosticism, some people call it magic. We'll talk with Gretchen Passantino of Answers in Action tomorrow on the program about Kabbalah. We'll find out what it is and what it is that Madonna and others are practicing. We're talking with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. We're currently on the topic of the new encyclical from the Pope. One more question, Uwe. We talked about the reaction of the ecumenists to this encyclical. What has been the general reaction to John Paul II's encyclical?
Well, the general reaction from the public at large has been, "Oh my God, how intolerant!" And if Christians can't even get together, somebody sent me an email saying, "It's how can you have Europe and you have 15 different electrical plugs, and how can you have Christianity and we can't commune together?" That's been the reaction, and this is, of course, by people who are actually not theologically apprised on this. But the general thing is, of course, that I'm rather defensive of the Pope, because when he says that the Eucharist is the recapitulation of the heart and the mystery of faith. Well, we Lutherans come pretty close to that. I understand that that the Pope does not want the Eucharist to be mushy, cuddly sort of affair where we all Christians hold wet paws and say we're brothers. Somehow we have to know what is going on there, and it's from that point on that I think one should really talk about intercommunion between between denominations. The reaction, the general reaction is, because we are so far removed now from theology and it's only feel-good stuff that seems to count, so the reaction has been very negative.
You alluded to this before, Uwe, but is it true that not only the Roman Catholic Church, but the Church historic, even in the time of the Reformation, has seen fit to practice what is commonly called closed communion?
Yes. It has, and so does the Orthodox Church. Yes.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about a story that's come out of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and it has a connection to Washington, D.C., involving one Senate Democratic leader, Tom Daschle.
Yes.
What's the story there, Uwe?
Well, the story is actually the Weekly Standard magazine, which is a conservative magazine published here in Washington, that broke a story that the Catholic Bishop of Sioux Falls, who is Tom Daschle's bishop, instructed him in a letter, evidently, not to pose as a Roman Catholic or go around saying what a great Catholic he was. And the reference was, of course, the reason was, of course, Daschle's position, among other things, in the abortion question. It's a fascinating thing. We're talking about, again, a similar thing, two kingdoms. And actually, this bishop makes a very interesting point. He refuses to discuss this with the media, and I think he's right to do so. He said it's a pastoral discussion, he said. However, then he goes on to say the pastoral thing to do for Daschle is to pray for his conversion. So that is very clear. So in other words, Daschle, who is actually, anyway, he's divorced and has remarried, and so therefore is technically excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church, but he is not supposed to push his Catholic sort of identity, although he himself says he is and always has been and always will be a Roman Catholic.
Now, this comes also on the heels of a recent pronouncement from the Vatican having to do with Roman Catholic politicians and how they legislate. What did the Vatican have to say then?
Well, the Vatican draws some very clear lines where the behavior of politicians in public life does not touch on religious affairs, and then on the other hand, where there are situations where obviously a Christian cannot believe one thing and do something else, and that of course is the case on the abortion issue. And there, this is a very, very fine letter, which has been edited by Cardinal Ratzinger, but has been approved by the Pope, which to me reads very, very close to what Luther would have said.
You say that the issue here really is cultural relativism. What do you mean by that, Uwe?
Well, cultural relativism is that anything goes. What you happen to believe at any given moment is correct and is right, that is right. So therefore, there are no longer any standards that have been handed down, as we Christians believe, from God. and that have developing traditions. And its cultural relativism that accepts the blessing of same-sex couples, it accepts the ordination of actively homosexual pastors, or it accepts abortion, and that is, and then of course there are many other things. And it is against this cultural relativism that I am reading Ratzinger's letter. And we know, of course, that this is one of the things that is that the Pope finds particularly troubling as cultural relativism, and which he is preaching against, as is Ratzinger.
You also say that this is not a uniquely Roman Catholic issue or
no,
teaching.
No, it's not uniquely Roman Catholic. I mean, you cannot. There are issues, for example, where I believe, as a Lutheran, if I were, even when I write, as a Lutheran journalist, I mean, I cannot write against my own faith. I cannot say it in an editorial. It is all right to slaughter unborn life. I can't do this. Either I'm dishonest with as a journalist, or I'm dishonest as a Christian. But either way, it's wrong. And so therefore, I there is one thing that it's one thing to have arguments in the secular field on, for example, should there be affirmative action or not. I mean, these are issues that you have to debate politically. But where there are questions that are closely linked to our belief, any Christian belief in the sanctity of life, for example, and the worth of the human being, the entire the worldview, the way we look at the human being, and we actually act against this as politicians and say, oops, yeah, well, you know, we have to do this because of all these other guys, but I actually, basically, I'm still a Christian. I don't think that's right, and I don't think this is right from a Lutheran perspective, and it's certainly not right from a Catholic perspective.
So you would have, at least it sounds like you would have a problem with, say, a Lutheran politician who said, hey, I'm a Lutheran, but I'm pro-choice.
Oh, absolutely.
Or, hey, I'm a Christian, but I'm pro-choice.
Yeah, so he's dishonest. He goes around and says, I'm Christian and I'm pro-choice. He goes around saying, I'm a Lutheran, and then gives the impression that it's okay with his Lutheran faith to approve abortion other than under very strict circumstances, given certain circumstances that we're not discussing here. You can't. I mean, then you're dishonest. You're dishonest as a Christian. You're dishonest as a politician. And you're dishonest as a human being.
You conclude your discussion of this in your column for UPI, which was called "Commentary: When Must Bishops Intervene?"
Yeah.
You conclude by saying that really, Daschle's bishop Carlson is being as pastoral as he can be.
Yeah.
What do you
wonderful.
Mean?
Yeah, wonderful. He says, "Look, I'm not going to discuss this in public. It came out. It's a shame it did. But what we have to do is I'm not going to ever end the dialogue as a pastor with my flock or with a member of my flock, even if I think the member of my flock happens to be wrong on a certain issue." So he prays for that person. In this case, he prays for Daschle. He prays for his conversion. What else would a pastor do? And he tells him, look, you have to change your ways. This is what Scripture says. I think this man is absolutely fantastic.
Let's talk a bit about the Shroud of Turin. It seems to surface again and again in the headlines, but
yes,
this time there's some concern about its safety or its restoration or non-restoration. Tell us about this petition to the Pope himself.
Yeah, it's a funny story, actually. That's been going on for quite some time. Last year, under the auspices of the Archdiocese of Turin, two Italians and two Germans have taken out the shroud, cleaned it up, separated it from a linen, a very, very expensive linen onto which nuns had sewn it in the 16th century, and after a fire, and then cleaned up the bits of carbon around there, because there had been a fire in the monastery, And then this woman, this German textile preserver who was actually living in Switzerland, evidently even ironed it, and, you know, she's been very Teutonic about it. And now there is, and I wrote this last year in the UPI, and then, of course, a guy in Hong Kong who's an American but at the University of Hong Kong picked it up and said, oh, my God, she has done so much damage, and, you know, every bit of every detail, every milligram of carbon or whatever should have been preserved because it can, and there were creases there, for example, and these creases could have been used to determine when the shroud was actually folded back in Byzantium in maybe in the 3rd or 4th century or whenever. And so, you know, here is this big argument, and then so he and a bunch of other guys, altogether 54 by now, scholars, mainly archaeologists, but also others, theologians and others from all denominations, have appealed to the Pope to not let this happen again, because there should be an international commission supervising the shroud. I used a slightly tongue-in-cheek, not really, but I mean slightly, because it's the interesting part is really that the shroud is being taken very, very seriously, more and more and more so. And this is the reason why I used this again, did a rather large commentary on it. It's being taken seriously. That woman in Switzerland, for example, says, you know, and so did the guy in Hong Kong, I've never seen anything like it. It is so unusual. It is clear from looking at it that it could not have been a paint job, nor could it have been a rubbing. It is something else. And when you look at it carefully, then you can see that it looks as if there are burn marks, but only on one side of it. In other words, that is, the idea is, of course, that during the resurrection, Christ might have exited through and left these marks. And it is very clearly, I've seen in Paris, in a Paris church, it's one of the most beautiful, it's the original photograph of the shroud that was taken in the 19th century when people suddenly realized they are sitting on something rather important here. It is, you're aghast when you see it, because you can see, for example, the wound, the stab wound on the side of Christ. You can see the nail marks, and you can see that that Christ that must have been, that this crucified man that had been covered by that shroud had worn a crown of thorns. All these things are there, and then, of course, there was carbon dating of it done in the 1980s, but that the sample had been taken only from one particular and very tiny spot of the shroud, and both the people, the German woman and the guy and these 52 others that have now appealed to the Pope not to have the thing again, done again as the German woman had done. But anyway, all these people believe, of course, that this was a very shoddy job. The carbon dating should have been samples taken from three different parts of the shroud, and then we would have probably arrived at the conclusion that the shroud, that this shroud did not date from, I think it was the 13th century, as the carbon dating suggested, but it would have been as old as, first century.
Two questions on that, Uwe. Yeah. First of all, who actually owns the thing? And then how likely is it that the Pope will offer protection for the shroud?
Well, the shroud owns and is in the cathedral. I suppose it must belong to at least the Archdiocese of Turin in Italy claims to own it. Okay, and it is in the cathedral. It's hidden. It's there. But of course, most Catholic, indeed most Christians, would say that it belongs to the entire church. But it is in the hands of the Archdiocese of Turin. As to the second question, the way I look at it, I'm quite sure that the Pope takes the shroud as seriously as anybody. And it makes a lot of sense to establish a commission of experts who will then say, okay, this can be done and this cannot be done. Let's not do this because that could damage evidence that this route might hold if we, for example, continue ironing it or dangling weights from it to make it look straight and that sort of thing. You know, so I believe I think the Pope will do that.
All right. Finally, I'd like to talk with you at some length here about an article that was solicited, an op-ed piece that was solicited on the pacifism of European churches from the Christian Century. You wrote the piece.
Yeah.
And before we get into what you said in the piece itself, I guess we'll have to touch upon that a bit here. How was it received at Christian Century?
Well, the interesting thing was at first the senior editor who commissioned it, I mean, they approached me. I had no dealings with them before. Said how wonderful it was and how timely, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then I got a letter. I got a very unpleasant, and in fact, I mean, from considering that this thing is calling itself Christian, an almost rude email here saying that they could not do it, and the rest of the staff had read it, and it, because I was taking a harsh or a rigid Lutheran Two Kingdoms line, and never mind that he even misread that, but I mean, he just, without apologies, refused. And, you know, I've been spending a lot of time on that. I'm a professional writer. But that's neither here nor there. The very, very thing is quite clear from his email that it was a knee-jerk reaction to my mentioning the Lutheran Two Kingdoms doctrine.
Now, let's go through that then. How did you answer the question of explaining Europe's pacifism, in particular among the Protestant churches there?
Well, I explained that, in fact, the title that I'd given this article was The Theology of Angst. And I explained to begin with that the church and civilians and Germans are angst-ridden, and that is actually goes back to certainly to World War II. I mean, we are, and pastors, Protestant pastors, or indeed Catholic priests, do not address this, but rather actually fan this fear that Germans have, which that fear, which has been a topic of a very interesting book in the 80s already, Die Deutschen Ängste, fan this fear, and pour more oil into these flames, you see, and but this is how I explained it in the first place. And then I said, of course, the clergy in Germany, both Catholic and Protestant, have come out with a sort of mantra. And I said, you know, praying a mantra is not Christian. It's another religion praying mantras. But the mantra is that by God's will war is not to be. Totally disregarding and leaving out just war doctrines, which both the Catholics and the Lutherans have had, now rather precise and rather rich, actually, leaving all this out. And then I said, you know, and because they do not, they no longer teach or understand, think along Two Kingdoms lines. And I said, you know, it's thinking beyond the first comma in a sentence that everything is sort of dialectical. Because of this, they do not even bother to explain the rational reasons for or against war. I mean, I'm not suggesting that they all have to be in favor of war. It's simply that they should, if they want to debate it, then they have to say, well, you know, we can't just debate this from a churchly point of view or a gospel point of view, as little as you can debate whether you should drive at a green light or red light. The gospel has nothing to say about that. So therefore, I then said, you know, it's because they are, I use the word Luther vergessen, they have forgotten Luther, and of course they've forgotten theology, and therefore they have inflicted on the church in Germany a lot of damage. And the very fact that I dare to mention the two kingdoms doctrine, which I actually mentioned only in passing, of course it is a two kingdoms argument, made the Christian century actually flip their lids. I mean, and so I wrote back to them and said, well, Cedro and Senzio, I conclude from the point of view of the Christian century, the only good Lutheran is a bad Lutheran.
Now, they understood you as saying, we only have about a minute here before we have to go. They understood you as saying that via Luther's two kingdom teaching, the churches in Germany had no business speaking out on war, period, and therefore they didn't want your op-ed piece that they had solicited printed.
Yeah, evidently. You know, he claims, the editor-in-chief, that I said Christians may not, Christians have no basis for criticizing political policy, which is not what Luther has said and which is not what I have said. It just goes to show that there is one deeply ingrained prejudice among certain Protestants in this country, and they are usually of a liberal variety, which is anti-Lutheran. The minute you mention one key element of Lutheran doctrine, they flip their lids and they go bananas, you see. And then they don't even apologize for it.
So, did this get published one way or the other?
I don't know whether, you see, I just come back from France this very minute, actually, so I haven't even checked whether it's been published. I've sent it obviously to some others, but it certainly did not get published in the Christian century. It may have got published in Christianity Today.
Uwe Simonetto, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. Now, you can read all of Uwe's excellent columns on the internet at upi.com. I would recommend that you especially read the one that's called Whence Europe's Pacifism, that was to appear in the Christian century, but then, since they apparently cannot stomach the distinction between the two kingdoms of God, it didn't get published. It is there, The Theology of Angst by Uwe Simonetto. You can read it at upi.com. All you do is, when you get there, type Uwe's first name into their search engine, U-W-E, U-W-E, and you will find these articles by Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. Tomorrow on the program, three excellent conversations for you. First of all, we'll be talking with Linda Preuss about Christians and mental illness. We'll be talking with the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for May, called The Spirituality of the Cross, Dr. Jean Edward Veith, about the central teaching of the Christian faith, namely the doctrine of justification. And Gretchen Pasentino will join us to talk about Kabbalah. Last night on Dateline, Madonna said this is her chosen form of spirituality. It helps her deal with the ups and downs of being rich and famous. We'll find out what Kabbalah is tomorrow on Issues Etc. You know, when you look back over what Christians are willing to tolerate by way of Christian teaching, Uwe's got a point. The ability and the willingness to forget Luther is, in a lot of ways, the ability and the willingness to forget much of what the Christian faith teaches. Not because it's hinged on Luther, because Luther brought it back to light through the clear teaching of the gospel. You wonder whether that's been forgotten as well. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.